I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Cabot Creamery, celebrating 100 years of being a dairy farm family-owned cooperative. Learn more at cabotcheese.coop. That's cabotcheese.coop. This week on a special bonus episode of Meat in 3, we find out why the bacon, egg, and cheese, that classic bodega sandwich, is popping up on menus of New York's trendiest restaurants.
We did a few iterations of it, and I was trying to fancify it. We tried the sausage, egg, and cheese, and then we tried to put shamula sauce on it. We used feta cheese, and we're just like taking ingredients of the Mediterranean, if you will, and try to infuse it. But for me, it was like a car wreck.
Tune in to hear about the wild journey of the bacon, egg, and cheese, from deli to fine dining, on Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we are going to talk about a little-known lobbying organization that drew my attention from an article in the New York Times by Andrew Jacobs. Andrew is a reporter with the Health and Science Desk of the Times, based in New York City, but he previously reported from Beijing and Brazil. He's also worked as a metropolitan reporter, or metro section, I should say, with stints at the Style section and the National Desk, covering the American South. Wow, what a portfolio. His reporting for the Times has included such varied topics as the presidential campaign, the aftermath of the earthquake in China, and the lead-up to the 2008 Summer Olympics, among many other topics. Andrew, you had an absolutely fascinating CV. I wish we'd had the time for me to read your entire fascinating biography. I mean, really? And you lived in China for quite some time, did you not?
7.5 years, but who's counting? Yeah.
Yeah. And you are a multilinguist, another thing that impressed me mightily. So in addition to Mandarin, do you also speak Cantonese?
I do not, no.
No. Is that less used? I display my ignorance here.
Because Mandarin is a national language of the official sort of language of China. Cantonese is really only spoken in the South and in Hong Kong.
Oh, I see. And where did you live? I mean, we're totally digressing here. I'm wasting time. But nevertheless, where did you live in China?
Did you live in Beijing? Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Fantastic. Okay, so let's thank you, by the way, so much for joining me today.
Sure.
I know that this is kind of a long ways away from your, you know, because being a reporter, you've got a new story every week, if not more rapidly. But in September, I noticed this article in the Times that was kind of breathtaking, that you had written about a very little-known lobbying organization called, improbably enough, the International Life Sciences Institute. So what captured your attention about the ILSI, given the fact that it has such a low profile?
Well, ILSI, as it's called in the industry, they've been on my radar for a while because they do fund a fair amount of studies on food and nutrition, but they've also kind of under a lot of criticism lately around the world because they've been expanding their activities, especially in the developing world. They have 17 offices, and they sort of bill themselves as a sort of independent research kind of institute. But if you sort of very gingerly lift off the cover, you'll see that they are maybe a bit more than that. They are funded entirely by the Goliaths of the food and chemical industry, from McDonald's to Cargill to Coca-Cola. And in fact, they were established by Coca-Cola, by a Coca-Cola executive in the late 70s. a guy named Alex Malaspina, who ran ILSEE for many, many years. He retired, I think, in 2005 or 6, but he's still quite active with the organization. And since then, they've expanded greatly their activities around the world. And they have a budget of $17 million, all of it provided by their members, which are all, food and drug and chemical companies.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking Pepsi-Cola, we're talking Monsanto, now known as Bayer.
Tell us,
who are some of the other big players in this? Cargill, you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Nestle, General Mills, all the big companies that sort of dominate the processed food industry are members. The only one who actually is not, last year, Mars, the candy maker, actually mm-hmm. backed out. And one of the executives there said they could no longer support an organization that funds advocacy-oriented studies. And that was sort of an outlier. But most of the other members are pretty, they stand by the organization. And it's a way for these companies to have some influence on nutrition policy around the world without sort of getting, having their hands dirty or getting too closely associated with some activities that have been, criticized as being kind of advocacy-oriented, favoring the interests of these, sort of corporate behemoths.
Right. So in other words, Coca-Cola is not about to publish a paper that says that drinking Coke is good for you. But ILSEE might say, well, it's not so bad. Is that kind of how
it
works?
Well, yes. And in fact, it's funny you mentioned that, because what Coca-Cola has done is they've backed away from this. But they, in recent years, they funded this organization called the Global Energy Balance Network. And this was sort of a stealth organization that was trying to say that obesity is not a problem of too much calorie intake or too much sugar intake, but about not enough exercise. And they tried this, funding this organization, and New York Times, Anahad O'Connor, sort of uncovered the link to Coca-Cola, and they sort of folded that effort. But that was pretty controversial. And ILSEE has, in China, for example, ILSEE is very, very powerful. They share offices and staff with China's CDC, Center for Disease Control. And they, in recent years, have been pushing this very same theory that more exercise is the answer to the obesity crisis, not reducing, your intake of basically junk food and soda.
Right, right. So how, describe the organization. Like, how does this actually work? Do they have 17, you said they have 17 chapters or something like that.
They have 17.
And they have a budget of $17 million, so that's sticking in my head.
Yeah, they have a lot of...
And they started in the 1970s, yeah. So they've been doing this for a good 40 years.
Yeah, like, they also have a publication, Nutrition Journal, that is fairly well regarded, that they fund. They have another research arm, and they got a lot of bad press in the 90s for funding some of the anti-smoking or funding some sort of stealth work to delegitimize the anti-smoking legislation. They were trying to sort of project an alternate narrative that, about smoking. That was a really bad moment for them, because it was sort of uncovered what they were really up to. And they've since disconnected from any kind of smoking work. They did. Philip Morris at the time, I think, was active. And they no longer allow smoking or tobacco companies. And then they sort of shifted to focusing mostly on food nutrition policy. In the early 2000s, they ran into trouble with the WHO. They were part of some of these non-governmental organizations that were involved in making policy, and they lost their access to WHO because it was uncovered that they were actually pushing policies that were favorable to the food industry.
Wow. And who did the uncovering in that case? It wasn't you.
No, that was the WHO itself.
I see.
Yeah. And they lost some of their access there. And they've sort of since tried to, they've really tried to outward looking changed their policies and issued very strong statements about their independence and that they won't get involved in policy making. And so they've tried to kind of clean things up, but according to critics, they haven't really, because they've sort of taken on this new tactic of having its members and trustees become active in different countries on their nutrition panels, government nutrition panels, and other efforts to pass food legislation. They get involved in that on the inside, and that's really where they've been criticized, because ILSI will say they're not an industry group, and others say they are. They are a front group for industry. So therein lies sort of the tension.
Yeah. And who are the experts that they find? Are they academics? Are they scientists? Are they people who have in the manner that we revolve experts in and out of government and industry in this country? Is it sort of that kind of thing, like where somebody would work, say, for the, the pork board, but then they would then work for ILSI as an expert on
correct,
meat consumption?
Correct. That's exactly what they would do. There are a lot of scientists out there, a lot of academics who will, they're employed by a university, but they will also do consulting work for the food industry. They will sort of have two taskmasters. They will be on ILSI's board, but they'll also represent a university, and they'll publish legitimate papers on nutrition, and that's probably where they run into the most trouble. Earlier this month, there was a bit of a brouhaha over a paper that ran in the Annals of Internal Medicine that claimed that eating red meat and processed meat was not as bad for you as everyone had been led to believe. And that study really very controversial. And then it turned out the guy who led that study had gotten money from ILSI that he didn't disclose for a previous controversial study that downplayed the dangers of excess sugar consumption. Is the kind of a typical situation that you'll see, is that these academics will kind of push or advocate sort of counterintuitive nutritional studies that will, maybe make things less, seem less onerous or ominous in terms of consuming unhealthy food products like sugar or meat. So that's kind of how
that's
it works.
That story got so much play because it was just such an outrageous and I thought very poorly constructed article. I mean, in and of itself, the article was, it cited that one study in a sea of literally thousands of others that were completely contradictory. I was amazed that it got the press that it got.
So what's interesting about these kinds of studies that they do, they're not fresh research. What they do is they sort of mine existing bodies of research. Mm-hmm. They'll go through, hundreds of other studies, and they will draw a conclusion based on their sort of analysis. And that has been criticized by some who say you can basically look at any body of research and sort of draw any conclusion you want. And that's the case of this meat study, as critics said, that they just sort of picked out favorable sort of data points that would back up this contention that eating a lot of red meat is not, in fact, bad for you. So I think that is a tactic that is kind of under some criticism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like on the front page for the next week, it got displaced by the usual Trump circus, but it was a really big
and
deal,
the author,
certainly for anybody.
Why that happened is because the study required the authors to disclose any conflict of interest within the last 3 years, and the lead author of that paper did not disclose that he had received money from ILSI in fact, during that three-year window. What he later claimed is the money actually had come in a few months before the cutoff point. Even though the study was dated in that window, he said, I got the check before the cutoff. And, you know, a lot of people said that's disingenuous. You know, you're just sort of fudging that. You know, it'll err on the side of excess caution, and you would have been better off disclosing that, and maybe might have avoided this brouhaha. But you know, that's the kind of thing you're dealing with here.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I looked at their website for, you know, quite a bit of time preparing for this, and it is absolutely benign. I mean, like the average consumer looking at this thing would never dream that the articles that they promote in their magazine or that the studies that they're supposedly funding are anything but absolutely, you know, 100% above board and you know, in the public interest. I mean, they have sections like sustainable agriculture and nutrition security and food safety, science and health. And I ended up reading a long article on fruit juice. Which they claim should be considered part of five servings a day of fruit and vegetables, with the caveat that it, you know, mustn't have any added sugar. But I was, you know, I scrolled. I didn't end up reading the whole thing because it really went on and on. And I know that juice has essentially been, you know, debunked as something that is going to substitute for a serving of fruit and vegetables, although this article was saying that if you're not getting any, it's better than none, okay? But I was not surprised.
Fiber. You're not getting the substance of fruit, which is, you know, the fiber. You're
the
just
fiber,
getting
exactly.
The sugar. That's,
but it went on a great deal about the, you know, the polyphenols and the various other components. But what was really interesting is that I get to the very end of the article and I look at the author and I see that, you know, it says the study was not funded by any juice company, but the author had served on the scientific advisory board of the European Fruit Juice Association. So, you know, you know, at the end of the day, when you see something like that, I mean, I think that's going to kind of almost immediately discount a lot of what you've read. But I will say that the references cited in this article, which were lengthy, seemed pretty legitimate. So, you know, talk a little bit about how they kind of get away with sort of, I don't know what to call it, greenwashing or whitewashing what is going on here. As you said, you know, they're cherry picking their sources, they're cherry picking their references. What would the average consumer or even the average kind of policymaker, if they were not primed to look suspiciously,
you would have
at this
no way of knowing. And that's just,
you have
know,
no idea, right?
The problem is that it's done in a way that's so subtle that, you know, it really takes a professional who's in that industry to know what's going on. And you know, this is the like, for example, you know, the main chemical in Roundup, the weed killer that has been in the news, glyphosate. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Now, the WHO, for example, ruled that substance is probably a carcinogen. That's the way they worded it. And then there was a subgroup that was put together to sort of, after the industry sort of reacted with horror, they put together a subgroup to look at this. And the two people who were on that group were ILSI members who were connected to the chemical industry. And that panel came up with the opposite conclusion, which is it probably wasn't a carcinogen. So, you know, that's kind of where they come under criticism, because even, you know, they use presumably scientific methods to come up with their determination. But, you know, if you look at the possible biases of the people making the decision, it makes you question, you know, and that's where, you know, it's about, a lot of times it's about perception of conflict of interest. You know, sometimes it's not enough just to really not have any obvious conflict of interest, but it's about the perception of conflict of interest. And I think that's where they run into problems.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to take a short break for a sponsor drop. I'll be right back with Andrew Jacobs from the New York Times. We're going to talk a little bit more about this shadowy group, ILSI. Stay tuned and we'll be right back.
K Cabot Creamery is proud to be celebrating 100 years making the world's finest dairy products. Cabot's award-winning cheddars and other dairy products stand apart because of their farmers' tireless dedication to quality and freshness, to healthy land and a sustainable future. A century after they started this journey, Cabot's farmer owners still know what matters most: family and community. The simple truth that we're stronger together than we are apart. That delicious products are the reward of a job well done. That when you love what you do this much, the best is always still to come.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe, taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Tickets available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, talking today with Andrew Jacobs from the New York Times. We're talking about a really interesting and very under-the-radar lobbying group called ILSI, which is the International, now I've forgotten what it actually stands for.
Life Sciences Institute.
Life Sciences Institute. I know. That to me right there is kind of suspect. It sounds
it's
like a Sun Myung Moon organization, doesn't it? So, Andrew, let's talk a little bit more about the article, because you really describe some kind of fascinating and illustrative incidents. So you talked about a lot about India, which has its own obesity problems, and they are trying to curb the consumption of sugary beverages, or as many other countries are. And so there is a certain certainly kind of infamous in my mind, a guy named Dr. Sezikaran, who was working in India. Talk a little bit about what he was doing there.
Well, I think what happened in India is really quite illustrative about how these things work. So Dr. Sezikaran was a very esteemed nutritionist who worked for the government, for the government's sort of main nutrition institute. He retired about 7 years ago, and then he immediately went in sort of to consulting for food companies. And so last year, India's sort of main food, their sort of equivalent of the FDA, passed a warning label regimen where they would put these red labels on unhealthy processed food packaging to sort of warn people that this stuff isn't good for you. And industry reacted quite unfavorably. And so the agency immediately suspended the rule and said, okay, we're going to put together an expert panel to consider this, or reconsider this. And they put Dr. Sezikaran at the head of this panel. So this immediately raised red flags, and there's been a lot of criticism about why he is heading this effort. I should mention that he is an ILSI trustee, and he's very active in ILSI, the global network, based in Washington. So he's constantly flying back and forth to Washington and to meetings all over the world. And I should say that these are not paid positions, which is adds another kind of gray area. He's not getting money, but he does get all expense paid travel around the world, and gets to stay in nice hotels and go to meetings. So this was, sorry about that. I've got a cold. So this is something that has kind of raised a lot of red flags. The agency in India still has not issued the decision, but there has been a sort of a bit of an uproar about his presence on this panel. So this is what you kind of see a lot in the developing world. And what ILSI's been sort of brilliant at is they've expanded their activities in among these 17 branches. Most of them are in the developing world. There's a bunch in Latin America. There's, as I said, in China and India, Middle East. I mean, they really focused on places where consumers are finally have enough money to afford these kinds of processed food, and it's a real growth market for the multinational food companies like Nestle and General Mills and the like, and McDonald's and Coke. So what they've been good at, it, because they don't, these countries don't necessarily have a very well-developed infrastructure of, you know, health and nutrition infrastructure, especially, you know, nonprofits, they kind of get in on the ground floor and try to help shape the creation of these policies. So that's kind of where we decided to focus. India, China, for example, we did a story earlier on, as I mentioned, this sort of extraordinarily close connection between ILSI, China, and that country's CDC. Like I said, they share offices, they share staff. The guy who's running ILSI China is also the CDC's top, you know, and he says there's no conflict of interest there. Of course, that in any other country, that would be said, you know, said to be absurd. How can you do both, have wear both hats at the same time? Brazil, they've been fairly active, sort of in getting their people on government advisory panels that were formerly kind of occupied by university academics. So it's a very, very brilliant tactic, and it works. It has been working.
Clearly. Because clearly those food companies are expanding exponentially into those new markets, and they're doing a great job of promoting their products. I mean, in a now distant trip to Vietnam, like 5 years ago, I was literally in these tiny little villages in North Vietnam in the mountains where, you know, electricity was spotty, but there was a cooler full of Coke and Pepsi.
Well, yeah, you can get Coke in places where you can't get medicine. You know, what's extraordinary, you know, and this has been extensively studied, and, you know, in Africa, for example, you can't get certain kinds of vaccines and medicine into places because there's no refrigeration, but you can get a cold Coca-Cola. So it's, you know, and the reason I think this matters is because processed food, we've already seen what's happened in our country where you have, you know, this soaring rates of obesity, you know, you have some 50% of Americans are overweight or obese. And in the developing world, of course, up until recently, you had malnutrition. And so that flipped. And I say malnutrition for lack of food. And what's happened now is you have a growing obesity crisis, and a lot of that is still malnutrition, but it's people who are getting plenty to eat, but the food that they're getting to eat, this fast food, this processed food, doesn't actually have much nutritional value. And so processed foods are replacing traditional kind of wholesome foods that nations for millennia sort of depended on for their sustenance. So, you know, they'll displace a traditional cooking in a place like Brazil or India, which would rely on whole foods of vegetables and legumes and rice, and getting people to switch to, you know, instant noodles and other kinds of processed food that unfortunately aren't really good for you. So it's in a really important battle that's being fought, and there's not a lot of attention has not been paid to that.
No, there isn't. And I, you know, and to push a little further on that, it's not just that they're pushing things like instant noodles, but also the pushing of cheap proteins like McDonald's hamburgers or Kentucky Fried Chicken, two things that I saw all over Vietnam as well. And so even though there's a tradition of eating meat in both of those in that country and throughout the middle the Far East, it's you know, encouraging people to eat it in ways that will definitely have an impact on their ongoing public health. And that to me is, you know, and the loss of culinary traditions, which has had such a tremendous impact on our own public health here in the United States. I want to go on for a second because one of the things that really interested me also was you saw some emails that pertain to the World Health Organization stance on sugar, and there were emails that you read that said, you know, described their efforts to influence Dr. Margaret Chan, who at that time anyway of writing was running the WHO. I think she's still the head of it, but talk about that a little bit because that was very.
That was quite revealing.
It was kind of alarming.
Margaret Chan, she actually no longer is the head of WHO, but at the time she was really keen to sort of do more on obesity, the growing obesity crisis. And she was coming, you know, trying to get the WHO to take a strong stance on this. And that really alarmed certainly Coca-Cola and ILSI members. And there was an organization called U.S. Right to Know that through Freedom Information Request got some of these emails because they were sent between ILSI's brass and some academics at public institutions, public universities. So that was they were accessible. And what some of those emails showed was this gentleman, Alex Malaspina, who founded ILSI, who retired but is still quite active. He was sort of emailing people at ILSI saying, "We need to do something to counteract this. She's going to destroy, you know, our industry, our business." And other people responded in agreement, and they were trying to come up with ways to get to her and try to influence her. And I think that was quite revealing. It showed that he is certainly still active, with the organization. And then last year there was a whole to do with ILSI Mexico, because at the time Mexico was basically imposing a soda tax, very aggressive soda tax, because they have a serious obesity problem. And so ILSI Mexico organized in the midst of all this a conference on sweeteners that the panel, the members of that panel were sort of famously pro kind of sweetener, pro soda industry. And that brought a lot of negative attention to ILSI. So ILSI, what they did was disbanded Mexico. And the email sort of showed from Alex Malaspina said, you know, this is a shame that we had to do this. We've hit rock bottom, and we can figure things out. And so they dissolved Mexico, ILSI Mexico. But then a year later, it was back up and running with a former president of vice president of Mexico's Coca-Cola outfit. So ILSI Mexico is now run by a former Mexico vice president of public affairs. You see that a lot, that ILSI's top brass are former industry people.
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, I have to say what strikes me most in listening to you and the reading that I did is the breathtaking cynicism of this organization and its proponents. I mean, the idea that you would, discuss internally how to influence Dr. Chan in order to promote the drinking of beverages that are clearly leading to poor health outcomes. I mean, it's just kind of mind-blowing. I shouldn't be surprised. I've been doing this radio interview thing for like 10 years. There's very little I haven't seen that hasn't, that isn't, but this is just on a level that it just kind of mind blowing. So to talk a little bit further, because we're going to have to wind this up in a couple of minutes, what kind of pushback comes? I mean, how do people, you've pointed out a few instances where they've been busted, for doing what they're doing, but in the main, they seem to be able to operate with impunity. What do you see any kind of efforts to discredit the organization or to somehow alert consumers or government or policymakers to their activities? I mean, what do you think is the end game here?
Well, there is a lot of effort, and I think you see a lot of it in the developing world. There has been a lot of pushback in India because they do have a pretty robust civil society. So there has been a lot of attention there. and that seems to be having some impact, especially with this red warning label. There's been a lot of fury over it. We don't know the outcome yet. In Mexico, certainly had the impact of dissolving ILSI, well, for temporarily. And in this country, there's definitely been a lot of attention paid to some of the industry's activities related to, food policy. I think it's basically, it doesn't really penetrate, I'd say, beyond kind of people in that world. We certainly try to publicize it, but I think for the average American, it's a little bit hard to kind of wrap your head around. So I think the main thing is just to kind of, we just kind of bring it to light and see what happens with it. But I do think they're on the defensive at the moment. It's not certainly denting their efforts, at least for now. But the best we can do is sort of shed some light on the situation.
Now, does that imply that you're going to continue following this story and that the New York Times will allow you to publish periodically updates on what an organization like this or others? I mean, certainly this is not an anomaly. It's not a one-off. There must be many others just like this, don't you think?
There's a lot of effort right now. The big, and in this country, of course, we have the kind of the worst of all worlds because the food industry is so powerful and lobby, not just ILSI, but all food organizations are so powerful that they've really stymied any meaningful, legislation in terms of soda taxes. They've been pretty aggressive on combating those. And then the food labeling is a big thing. We have, I would say, probably among the most backward food labeling systems. A lot of countries now use sort of a traffic light scenario on packaging where they'll have a red or yellow or green coloring on the label to say this is good for you, or if it's green or red, this is not good for you. And we don't have that in this country.
No, we don't.
Basically, you need to turn that package over, and you need to really be able to understand the fine print of the ingredients and what it means. And I think most people don't understand that, which is why I have a story that I think is coming out today or tomorrow about children's beverages, sweetened beverages, and how despite promises to sort of reduce marketing to children, two-thirds of all children's drinks are sweetened with sugar, artificial sweeteners. We have a pretty big kind of mountain to get up over in this country. And childhood obesity is, a huge problem. And soda, sugary beverages provide half of the sugar that we consume. This added sugar that really has no nutritional value and has been implicated in sort of skyrocketing rates of obesity and diabetes and hypertension and all these cardiovascular diseases.
Sure.
There's been some progress. People are definitely drinking more water than they did in the past, but there's still a lot of people and children drinking sweetened beverages.
Oh, no doubt about it. So you think your article, your newest piece will be out either today or tomorrow?
Yeah, that's more of a sort of a visual, it's sort of a visual kind of storytelling where we throw up a few different of the best-selling children's drinks and just sort of show how much sugar. For example, sort of Minute Maid lemonade, which you get in the produce section next to your orange juice. And, you drink one little glass of that and you're basically getting half of your, for a child, you're getting half of your sugar for the day. So a lot of these drinks, this apple, Adam and Eve fruit drink, for example, one serving of that, it provides all of your sugar in one glass for the day. That's something a lot of people don't understand. They have this notion that something like a fruity drink is somehow good for you, but it's actually, it's not 100% fruit juice. It's in the rest of the sweetener comes from sugar. So that is a sort of ongoing challenge, and you really need to have a PhD in public health to understand when you're shopping what you're buying for your kid, because it'll say on the front, 100% natural ingredients or 100% vitamin C. And you think, and it's got pictures of fruit on the label, and you're like, oh, wow, this is good for me. But if you look on the back, you'll see there's a lot of sugar in these beverages.
Yeah, you'll see that sugar is the second ingredient in any one of these, the first one being either juice or water.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, we have to drop it there. Andrew, thank you so much. Is there a place where people, do you have a website where people can follow all of your stories? Because I certainly plan to.
You can just Google my name, Andrew Jacobs, the New York Times, and you'll come up with a lot of the stories. We had a series last year called Planet Fat, which was a series that explored the sort of exploding obesity crisis in the developing world. We have a number of articles that, you know, from Ghana, from Malaysia, Brazil, that sort of detailed how these countries are sort of being inundated with processed food and the impact that's having on public health.
Wow. Incredible. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing, and thank you for appearing on the show today. I hope we can speak again. I really enjoyed the conversation, and there's a lot, you're working on a lot of stuff that is definitely germane to what I try to follow here on this program. So I really appreciate your time today, and I'll stay in touch. And thanks to my sponsor. Thank you to my listeners for tuning in, and I'll see you next week with another story. Talk to you soon. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.